Good morning. You are listening to KBOO Portland. This is More Talk Radio. My name is Cecil. I will be joined by Celeste. And we thank you for joining us. Today is Monday, March 2nd, 2009. The time is approximately 8:02 a.m. We thank you for joining us this morning, and we invite you to stay tuned and listen for our conversation with Randy Shaw. Let me give you our phone numbers if you wish to be a part of this conversation a little bit later. Our phone numbers are 503-231-8187. Don't call right now, but call sometime after we begin our conversation with Mr. Shaw and share your comments and thoughts. Let me remind you, if you have news or information to share with us, you can send it to us either by snail mail, 20 Southeast 8th, in Portland, or you may fax it to us through the fax number at the station, which I don't have in front of me, or you may email Celeste and I on our Gmail account, moretalkradio@gmail.com. You have that fax number?
Or you can send it by email to Community Calendar, and that's kboocommunitycalendar@gmail.com. And the fax number is 231-1745 with the 503 area code.
Excellent. Yeah. Always. Let me remind you that coming up on March 15th is a march and rally to keep Oregon God home from Iraq and Afghanistan. It will take place at the steps of the state capitol in Salem. That is Sunday, March 15th at 1 p.m. For transportation and other information, you may call Peace and Justice Work. Their number is 503-236-3065, or you can check them out on their website, pjw.info. That's pjw.info.
And I know that KBOO is also taking part in an event. I don't know if we have a cart for it or not, but it's the McKenzie River Gathering benefit, and that takes place in April.
Okay.
On a Saturday. And I think, let me check my calendar here, because I was about to say the date, and I wasn't sure if I had the right April here. I want to make sure I get the right April. Right, April 4th. I am right. And it will be at Pear downtown. So you can call either KBOO or you can call MRG for more information. And I'm sure we have a cart for that as well, because we're one of the co-sponsors.
Okay. Well, listen in on KBOO for that cart and other news and information.
Mm-hmm.
So if you have news or announcements, please share them with us so that we may share them with the larger community.
Yep.
Joining us today is Randy Shaw, who is the author of a book, Beyond the Field, Cesar Chavez, the UFW, and the Struggle for Justice in the 21st Century. And Mr. Shaw will also be at at the Multnomah Central Library, Collins Gallery, from 6 to 7 p.m.
Mm-hmm.
And Randy, what is that date?
That's March 4th.
Wednesday. Oh, March 4th. Okay, I'm a slow reader here. Okay. Okay,
well,
so in a couple of days.
All right, very soon here. And our guest today, Randy Shaw, in addition to being author of our book, is director of the Tenderloin Housing Clinic in San Francisco. And welcome to Portland and welcome to KBOO here on More Talk Radio.
I'm looking forward to being up in Portland in a couple of days.
Well, you know, it's so exciting that you will be in Portland. I'm sure you'll talk about your book and the movement. And I think it's probably appropriate, you may or may not know, that there's a move here in Portland to name a street after Cesar Chavez. And there was a lot of controversy in recent years when that came up. I think one thing that your book might be helpful in that it tells us the story of the man and the movement and the continued influence of those who were initially touched by the UFW organizing and the continuing legacy for social justice movement.
Well, even more than that, what it does is it points out how important, you know, this American man's contributions were to the whole idea of progressive social movement as well as mainstream social movement.
You know, I have followed the Oregon, the Portland renaming fight, you know, very, very closely, and I have been struck by and there's obviously some people who just don't like the name of a street to be changed. We had the same thing in San Francisco, where after we changed a street from Army Street to Cesar Chavez Street, the people put it on the ballot, and we had to, you know, approve Cesar Chavez. So it's always a controversial thing, changing a street name. But it has struck me, and one of the reasons I wrote this book, Beyond the Fields, is because people seem to think that Chavez is kind of a man out of the 60s or 70s, and they forget, as the book shows, how all the people he inspired, you know, all the, including Barack Obama, who took Yes We Can, Si Se Puede, and the whole model for Obama's campaign discussed in the book really came out of the farm workers movement. So it could be that some people think, oh, why are we naming something after a guy who's been gone a long time, not realizing his ongoing legacy, which is what the book sort of shows, including a section on his role in Oregon.
Yes. So I want to go back, though, before we touch on that, because, as you said, it's really important for us to recognize how much a history is a repeating pattern from when we learn, you know, the lessons and can move forward. But one of the things that I want to say, and this is basically touching and informing those who are not familiar with anything about Cesar Chavez, it's his beginnings here in this country. There are a lot of people who don't recognize that he moved here from Arizona, here meaning to California, to the West Coast. Some people have his origins in many other places.
Well, one thing that people there's two things about Cesar Chavez that many people don't know. One is that he was himself a farm worker, and lifting cantaloupes at age 13 really kind of wrecked his back for the rest of his life.
That in the short hoe.
He grew up in Arizona, but his family, and as a homeowner, with his father was a homeowner, then they lost what they had, and they lost their house, which is very common these days, of course, and they had to become farm workers. And the other thing that people don't know about him, which really guided the movement and still shapes things today, is how profoundly religious he was. And he really, I discuss in the book, the UFW really spawned so much of what's now faith-based activism, mm-hmm. alliances with labor. He was a very religious man and attracted many people from the religious community into the farm worker cause.
And in fact, because of his religious connection, his religious faith also ran into some challenges with supporters who were more secular. I'm thinking like the IAF and Alinsky.
Well, that's, yes. In fact, I find it often amusing where Saul Alinsky gets credit for Cesar Chavez when Alinsky the reason Chavez started to organize farm workers, he had to leave the IAF group because they wouldn't do it. Saul Alinsky actually, and I have this in Beyond the Fields, I say, Alinsky said that Latinos were an urban people and needed to be removed from the farms and brought to the cities. He thought Chavez was crazy. And when Caesar did his phenomenal 1968 fast, which ends with the historic photo of him and Robert Kennedy kind of breaking the fast, and really it just galvanized the whole movement, Alinsky told people that he was embarrassed that Chavez used such a tactic. So Caesar went beyond his Alinsky, and really Fred Ross Sr. was really more of a mentor to Cesar Chavez than Saul Alinsky ever was.
Two things I wanted to touch on that, but first I want to say one of the things that was really important was that it's typical for the United States and many countries to not know what's going on, because we can be a stratified society. But when Cesar Chavez started trying to promote the conditions that a lot of the farm workers were working in, it wasn't as though this was a story unknown to Americans, because we had John Steinbeck's book, Grapes of Wrath, which you pointed out in your book, which kind of promoted this idea. So folks were beginning to recognize that this not only impacted some of the poor whites and Filipinos and blacks that lived in rural areas and were farm workers, but most importantly, a lot of its Mexican farm workers were suffering from it, dealing with issues of racism. And so when you move into what was the beginnings of this progressive movement, to see this same kind of attitude played out is a little distressing, as you pointed out with Alinsky.
Well, you know, I think you make a great point, because people don't realize that there were efforts to organize farm workers for almost 70 years before, or 60 years before Cesar Chavez started. And that's why I think the story is so worth knowing, not only of how they possibly succeeded in what was far more challenging than the David and the Goliath struggle. It was an unbelievable, against California's most powerful agribusiness corporation, some of the most powerful corporations in the country at that time, but how the people, it trained so many people, as an incubator for so many people, mm-hmm. who then went off.
Yes.
And to this day, they formed Justice for Janitors. They've been involved in political work around the country. All the people he inspired, including your former mayor, Vera Katz, was very involved. And so that's what it took. And that's, it takes mass movements of talented people and creative people to make real change. I think that's what we've learned.
One of the things we learned from your book, as you mentioned, is that the union served as an incubator for many organizers who continue to work and continue to have an impact on our lives today, and taking the things that they learned from that movement to other movements. And so it's not only a good history lesson, but it's a good lesson in terms of how to organize today. And you touch upon several ongoing social justice movement that people take their influence from UFW.
Well, right. The Unite Here hotel boycott of 2006, this national boycott, which was a number of cities around the country. They were showing slides of the farm worker boycott and showing them how they did it and how to stop people from patronizing a hotel is like stopping people from buying grapes. I have a chapter in Beyond the Fields about an amazing campaign at the University of Miami to organize mm-hmm. janitors, which is like right out of the farm worker playbook, and it was orchestrated by a farm worker alum named Stephen Lerner of SEIU. The whole Justice for Janitors was formed because Lerner thought, gee, janitors are a lot like farm workers in high rises. And so that's why I think the most important thing about in my book is that this is not from the past, it's present. And that's why, I think a lot of people don't realize that it's an ongoing legacy. It's not something that they did in the 60s and 70s, and why are we talking about it now? Because it still really directs, including the Obama campaign, as I say, that kind of spirit of the way they did the organizing and outreach is right out of the farm worker electoral playbook from the 60s and 70s.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 here in the metro area, 91.9 if you are any points east in the Columbia River Gorge, Willamette Valley, 100.7 on the web, KBOO.FM. We're speaking with Randy Shaw, who is author of Beyond the Field, Cesar Chavez, the UFW, and Struggle for Justice in the 21st Century. Please join us. You can call in at 503-231-8187 and join in our conversation here. Ask our guest questions about politics from the social justice struggle from the beginning to now, and maybe even discuss some of the parallels with the Obama campaign and other rights issues. I'd like to, if you don't mind, Randy, disassemble some of the steps and some of the aspects of Cesar's early efforts at both organizing and looking at the structure of boycott. As you pointed out, it's not something that Cesar Chavez invented. Actually, it came from Ireland and named after,
Charles Boycott.
Right.
Yeah.
But one of the things that struck me is how he kind of looked at it on a systematic perspective and the components of a successful boycott. And what struck me is he not only looked at who was the target of the boycotts, and maybe how there was more than one target, like the people who owned the businesses, who paid the wages, who bought the products, who transported the products. He looked at all of the different aspects of a boycott and organized, I think, a very successful vertical boycott, both accidentally and on purpose.
Well, that's a great point, especially when you said accidentally, because he could never have interpreted and predicted the success. But here was the key thing about Cesar. What he brought to the farm, when he started organizing farm workers, he said, I've studied the history. We can't win a strike. Strikes don't work. But nevertheless, another group started a strike, and he sort of thought, well, gee, we can't show disloyal. But he knew strikes wouldn't work, so he was looking for a way to essentially, he knew he couldn't win the battle in the Central Valley, he had to go national. And so by turning the fight away from fighting with growers in Delano in Central Valley of California and saying, we're going to go to the supermarkets in New York, Montreal, Chicago. We're going to go to hundreds of cities and have people in front of supermarkets saying, don't buy grapes because of the conditions they're under. That was what did two things. One, it made it, everyone could say, hey, I want to help the farm workers think, so I won't eat grapes. And second, it required the recruitment of a huge number of people, many of whom that who became great organizers to this day. And so the boycott became the way in which they needed people, particularly women. And I discuss in the book how women really had no role in the labor movement in male-dominated unions except for the farm workers' movement. So if you were a woman like Susan Sation or Jessica Govey, this is the only place you could do labor organizing. Similarly with people from the New Left and progressive young people from of that generation, you know, the AFL-CIO supported the Vietnam War. They were in the Cold War politics. And, you know, young New Leftists didn't want anything to do with them. But, hey, the farm workers gave them a route into the labor movement. And so they became part of the boycott. So it really became this incredible consumer-based movement, unlike anything that we've really ever seen since. That kind of boycott has really never... And I discuss in the book how it got so bad, there were so few grape sales that Nixon... President Nixon had to have the Defense Department buy millions of pounds of grapes to make up for the ones consumers weren't buying.
And we say there's no subsidy for the rich.
Reagan and Nixon, the farm workers at the time of their high point, in the, when they were really battling in the 70s, they had Reagan as the governor of California and Nixon as the president.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And they overcame them both.
And what's really significant about that Reagan-Nixon alliance is that you also had Nixon breaking another really strong union, and that was the air traffic controllers.
Reagan. Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, they were both very anti-union, in fact, but the UFW didn't back down. And I discuss in Beyond the Fields how they went after, they were going to do a big protest at the 72 Republican convention, and if Nixon kept their, he tried to get some anti-farm worker bill legislation, and he just backed down. They made Reagan and Nixon back down, which shows you how mass organizing and the kind of strategies they used to build power succeeded.
And mass organizing is one thing that we take from your book in terms of how it's good to look back at history, but also look back at how those tactics can be used today. In a recent article in I think in the Huffington Post, you wrote about the Obama stimulus plan and suggested that it might use an old campaign, the neighbor to neighbor campaign,
right,
to persuade.
Right. I mean, some of your listeners probably remember the great Central America peace campaigns in the 1980s to stop aid to the Nicaraguan Contras. And, you know, what Neighbor to Neighbor did, which was headed by Fred Ross Jr., who was a farm worker alum, and his father was the trainer for Cesar Chavez, but they went into congressional districts and really fought and built constituencies opposition to Contra aid to the point where they actually won the... became the first, you know, they led, we defeated it in a key vote, and I describe. But the model is that instead of just sending out mass email alerts or phone calls, you do it in a very targeted way in certain districts, like they're now talking, as I say, in Arkansas to get some of those moderate Democratic senators. You have to actually go into the districts,
yes,
build constituency support, and that takes a lot of work and a lot of organizing. It's much easier, you know, to just send an email out to a mass group, say, call your congressman. But that's not as effective as what they did with Neighbor to Neighbor and sort of the UFW style, where you go into the district, build local support, so it's community people, not outside pressure groups, community people demanding their representative be accountable on these issues.
We will revisit that in a moment here. We have a couple of people who are being patient and holding online. Thank you for holding. Good morning. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Yes.
The early progressive movement was a, in the early 1900s, was a Christian separatist racist movement that used social programs or social engineering to isolate and segregate blacks from society. One of the ways they did this was minimum wage. Minimum wage was designed to price the minimum wage above what uneducated blacks, what people were willing to pay uneducated blacks, and that was to segregate them from society so they could be sterilized.
Okay, and in relation to our conversation this morning, you have a comment?
What I'm trying to say is the progressive movement shares the same philosophy. Its roots share the same philosophy as the Nazis.
Okay. Okay. Well, thank you.
Thank you for your call. You know, one of the interesting points out of what this caller makes through what is kind of a murky point is that that also was one of the reasons you had a really interesting practice we have in the States called tipping, which is the fact that you didn't want to pay blacks and other unskilled or skilled labor sometimes the prevailing wage, and so tipping was supposed to fill in the gap there.
Well, but, you know, when they passed the minimum wage as well as the Wagner Act, most of the African American employees, like doing domestic work, were excluded, and farm
anyway.
Workers were excluded. That's why you know, people often wonder if that's why the farm workers' challenge was so great, because they were not protected by any labor protections.
Yes. You know? Yes. And if you'd like to join in the conversation, 503-231-8187. I wanted to get back to that point you were making earlier, Randy, about getting into the community, getting to know people, standing with them in their concerns, and organizing along that basis. Because you mentioned the fact that women were able to rise to power, and, you know, something unheard of in these United States, you know, women of color. But also a lot of students, and you had students who had left the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, SNCC, and also Student for Democratic SDS, Democratic Society, who were not finding any more challenges, you know, for whatever reasons. I mean, SNCC didn't have as much work for a lot of the young white students, and so between them and the women who also had a fire, you know, in their stomachs, it was an opportunity to get out and get into the community.
Well, absolutely. And there were students who, you know, so many students who they might be, you know, during college, they just dropped out of college, you know, for good because they were so involved. And also, you know, what's often overlooked about the UFW's legacy and why they have such a profound influx on the current immigrant rights movement is they were a great breeding ground for Latino organizers.
Yes.
And it's sort of assumed, well, of course, but when you look at people like Eliseo Medina, Humberto Gomez, Jessica Govea, and the list, Gilbert Padilla, Dolores Huerta, you're talking about the great generation of Latino organizers at a time when, if you were Latino, there weren't a lot of jobs for you in organizing in those days.
Yes.
You know, and so, and when you look at why there's been success with Latino voting and the immigrant rights movement, and people like Miguel Contreras, who you know, the late Miguel Contreras, these are all UFW alums who were farm workers, not Dolores Huerta, but the others were all people who were farm workers who then, you know, just said, oh, you want to work on some organizing? Okay, and they became great organizers, something that we see janitors now doing today and other hotel workers becoming organizers. And that's really an opening that would not otherwise existed for these people. And Eliseo Medina, who's now executive vice president of SEIU, has said that, hey, if it weren't for the UFW, you know, he might have been, best he ever would, he might have been a ranch foreman.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, none of these folks would have ever gotten, you know, the ability, the opportunity to advance and show their organizing genius had it not been for the UFW.
Now, what it really thrills me is the contribution of women. With Dolores Huerta, she not only nailed their first negotiation contract, and I'd like to have you talk a little bit about her style and her legacy, but she's actually the author of the phrase, "Yes, we can."
Se puede, and I discuss in the book, there's a lot of difference of opinion, but, you know, the view, I think, she said when they were doing a recall of the Arizona governor, because they passed an anti-farm worker bill, she said, "Si se puede," and Caesar said that should be our theme. But, you know, another woman who's not as well known, who died in 2005, Jessica Govea, she actually, you could say, started the environmental justice movement in this country.
Mm-hmm.
Because she is a lot of people, especially in your listening area, very environmentally conscious. People don't realize that in 1969, before there was really an environmental movement, before the first Earth Day, the farm workers were out there saying, let's get rid of DDT.
Yes.
And they were saying that the problems with workers' health, that's an environmental issue. And the mainstream environmental groups, and I have a chapter on this in the book, they were saying, no, environmentalism, you save a lake, you save a mountain, you don't cut down a forest. It's not about workers in the Central Valley being sprayed with pesticides. Mm-hmm. And I discuss in the book how the UFW put that out there, ended up getting rid of DDT, but nevertheless didn't make the kind of alliances that they now have with the Sierra Club and other groups. So it's a very interesting period. Often people don't realize the role the UFW played in the legacy of the environmental movement.
One thing, in your discussion about the pesticides and the environmental justice movement, one thing that there's a line you wrote that I thought was very important, in that you said one thing that was very important is that the best strategy was through contract negotiation, given the lack of enforcement by state and federal authorities.
That's a great point you bring up. That's,
yeah.
Yes, I didn't mean to cut you off. I just said that you picked that up because, see, a lot of people don't know that the farm workers could have actually won contracts with a number of growers much, 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 much earlier than they did, almost 6 years earlier. But Cesar Chavez refused to sign a provision which the Teamsters Union was willing to sign, which said basically you can spray whatever you want on our workers. He said, if we win a contract, there's going to be no pesticides. And they said, well, no, we'll give you the wages, we'll give you the benefits, we're not going to do that. And he would not sign a contract for that. A lot of people don't know that, so I really appreciate you bringing that up. And I discussed that in the book because that shows you the commitment the UFW had toward worker safety.
And that whole idea of vertical organizing, too. Look at every aspect of the struggle and figure out which are the important things and capitalize on that.
Yeah, today, you know, people look at labor, and labor routinely makes alliances with students and religious groups, and they have a community part of a campaign. But when you look at when the farm workers were there, other unions weren't doing that. And I think people forget that, you know, at a time when most unions were just sending checks to Democratic politicians, the UFW was actually out in the field knocking on doors. And, you know, as I say, they were the people, if you look at, I describe in Beyond the Fields, what they did in the 1968 and 72 campaigns, people are going to say, boy, that's just what Obama did. Because, Obama kept such great records. It's amazing. They kept track of everything. Well, the UFW was so focused on that when they had their human billboards, a tactic which they created, they counted the number of cars that honked during the period. And they had a system which showed how many cars they were reaching, how many people waved to them. Everything was documented. So people knew that their individual contribution was making a big difference, which is what people felt good about in the Obama campaign.
Yes. You're listening to More Talk Radio here on KBOO Portland. And if you would love to join in the conversation, you would call at 503-231-8187 and speak to our guest, Randy Shaw. And you have an opportunity to learn more about the man that has inspired not only the way we do protests now, but is also someone that we are looking to in the city memorialize through, you know, naming a street or a portion of town after. I was really fascinated by this. This is a easy read book. What you do is you lay out a lot of facts, figures, information, and people and connect them. And it was reassuring to me to have a lot of dots connected because too often points are glossed over and we may lose some important connections like the one you pointed out, Cecil, about the way contracts were negotiated. And earlier I had mentioned the legacy of Dolores Huerta.
Yes.
And I'd like you to talk a little bit about her work and how it affects how we negotiate contracts now.
Well, what's interesting about Dolores is who was sent off to New York. You know, see, originally the boycott was going to be just against a couple growers. And then Dolores and Fred Ross and all realized that wasn't working because you could put other labels and you wouldn't know which. Someone would say one kind of company's grapes would be another. So you had to do the whole industry. And she was in the New York boycott, which, of course, New York became one of the most successful. And, you know, in that era, there were not a lot of women labor activists doing what Dolores Huerta was doing. I think that's pretty clear. And I discuss in the book how, you know, there was sexism, of course, in the UFW, in the UFW leadership, and in the media, and Beyond the Fields, I use an example that a young white Stanford student, where she was with Dolores, and the media wrote all about her, even though she was just a low-level person. This was Dolores Huerta on the executive board. So, you know, I discussed, you know, she recognized it was sexism, but she worked through it. I mean, she just went on and worked through it. And for that era, and you start saying, well, how many women labor leaders were there of that time, particularly in male-dominated industries? And there's they're only in the UFW. Because,
yes,
you know, women were hired in unions where there were women unions, but these were male, farm workers were primarily male, and you didn't have women leaders like Dolores Hart, who was on the executive board.
You're listening to KBOO. Give us a call. We have a couple of folks who have done just that, and welcome to More Talk Radio. Good morning, Steve.
Good morning. I just have a quick question. I'm under the impression that Cesar was against illegal immigration, and I'm wondering if you just said about the pesticides that that does prove how much he truly cared about the people. But my question is the current state of Los Angeles and the people, primarily the Hispanics, is that why he was against illegal immigration? So that we wouldn't have that collection of so many poor people and to hold down the Hispanics in that respect. And I'll get off and listen to your response.
Well, I really appreciate you asking that because I think one thing, if for no other reason, people should read Beyond the Fields, because I think I really clear up once and for all the myths about Cesar Chavez and undocumented immigrants.
Yes.
The reality was this. When someone was in the fields breaking a strike, Chavez wanted them removed regardless of whether they were undocumented, American citizens, whatever. And when growers would go across the border and bring in strike breakers, he wanted them removed.
Mm-hmm.
But when the UFW had their first constitution, they made no distinction between undocumented and documented immigrants. And they never did. They never paid attention as long as you were not a strike breaker. And I discuss in the book, there were some people on the left. There was a couple incidents that occurred in Arizona where, you know, the Caesar's calling the federales. Well, they, you know, and there were some bad incidents, but he always felt this is a labor issue and the strike breakers are getting exploited. And he's against the exploitation of any worker. He wants all workers to have, you know, decent wages. And so what things started to turn in terms of Los Angeles. I have like a long chapter in the book about how really the whole Latino voting, giant explosion of Latino voting that occurred nationally really began in Los Angeles by using the UFW methods under the leadership of Miguel Contreras, who was the head of the Labor Council of Los Angeles in 1996. And I track in the book the rise of Latino voting, first in Los Angeles, then in California, then in Colorado, Arizona, and other states, how it all came out of what they learned at the farm workers.
Mm-hmm.
So the immigrant rights movement, a lot of farm worker people, Eliseo Medina's played a critical role, came out, and the UFW is very involved in it today. And Dolores Huerta frequently is touring the country for immigrant rights. The movement had a lot of farm worker qualities, and it's very interesting. If you remember the giant immigration marches of 2006, remember all the American flags, the people that that came out of the farm workers, and I discuss in the book. Caesar always said, hey, no one's going to say that we're less patriotic. He'd have American flags out there at the UFW rallies in the same way that he understood the symbolism, and that I think he saw those immigration marches, which is the cover of my book, as a throwback to the UFW strategy. And that's why I think the media received them so much, because it was not seen as, you know, these weren't leftists or radicals. These are regular working families, which is the image the farm workers regularly conveyed.
And one of the other things you said, too, I think is really important, is how the growers would be the ones responsible for bringing up a lot of undocumented workers and thereby exploiting the farm workers.
Well, yeah, well, I mean,
you know,
Caesar
and so
would see growers go down south, there'd be a strike and they'd bring in strike
breakers.
And he didn't care what he just said this is wrong. He's against any strike breaker. And so, you know, I discuss in the book because there were some people on the left at the time very critical of him forever wanting the INS to be involved. But, you know, they said, you know, he had workers who food was taken out of their mouths so the growers could exploit people who they'd have work during a strike and they'd send them back over the border.
Yes.
So I think it's a much more nuanced assessment. But I frequently among the right wing, you frequently hear people say, Caesar was against undocumented. No, he wasn't, and he supported the immigrants. The UFW has been a consistent supporter of the immigrant rights cause for almost two decades now.
Well, you know, just to kind of hit one more point on that, it's really important for folks to hear that and to read it in your book to reinforce the fact that having, whether it was guest workers, which was an issue that they were dealing with back then, or looking at immigrant workers in the way that the caller characterized it, this whole division, this whole schism was something that was created by the growers themselves.
Absolutely.
You know, and so this is mainstream America or labor versus, you know, not labor, but rather the growers versus everyone's opportunity to have a fair life. They brought in the divisions. They created this dichotomy. They created the problem.
That's exactly right. And I think that, you know, what Beyond the Field sort of shows is that it was a movement of an incredible number of talented people. It wasn't just Cesar Chavez or Dolores Huerta who were the most prominent, but it was a whole group of very talented people who then, after leaving the union, went off and have done some really great, great things. And that's, I think people don't realize, I mean, many people, when Obama said, yes, we can, after mm-hmm. the New Hampshire primary, a lot of people didn't know that was Si Se Puede.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And most to this day probably don't know that the reason he did that at that occasion, many believe, even though he used it in a prior campaign, was that Maria Elena Durazo, who was Miguel Contreras' ex-wife, because he died, was a widow, and she's now head of the Labor Council and a longtime activist, she was going to endorse him in Las Vegas the next day with Unite Here. And so he was sort of saying, Unite Here, you know, Si Se Puede is really like their calling card. So it was a very conscious on Obama's part to connect Yes We Can to the farm worker legacy.
One thing that we're speaking this morning with Randy Shaw, who is the author of Beyond the Fields. He will be in town on Wednesday at the Multnomah Central Library Collins Gallery from 6 to 7:30 p.m. One thing that you do so well in the book, as Celeste mentioned, is tell the stories. And you mentioned earlier the University of Miami campaign, and I was wondering if you would talk a little bit about it for two things. One, it's an example of the extension of what was learned out of UFW campaigns, and it applies to a situation and a former Clintonite, Donna Shalala.
Yes. Well, Donna Shalala, you know, she was head of that campus, and when the janitors started organizing, people thought, oh, she was with Health and Human Services under Clinton. She certainly will support health care for her janitors. And, well, actually not. And the book was in the chapter in the book on which I called, the name of the campaign was Yes We Cane.
Yes.
You know, so, but it showed how you build on the farm worker legacy of clergy. That the Interfaith Worker Justice Group down there played an amazingly important role on campus and off. They did, you know, giant protests in front of Gloria Estevan's house. I mean, they brought in, you know, they put pressure on celebrities. They knew how to get media. There was Stephen Lerner told me he got more media generated in that campaign than even his famous Los Angeles Century City campaign the janitors did, and the Bread and Roses movie and all. I mean, the media, it was an amazing campaign, but it ultimately came down to janitors willing to go on a fast.
Mm-hmm.
And
yes,
they stopped eating, and students on a campus which is not often seen, that political campus, University of Miami, they stopped eating, and it became a very, you know, it became to replicate what you saw in 1968 with Caesar's fast. I mean, there was just this powerful spiritual transformation of the whole thing, which turned out, people can read in the book, it's a very, very happy ending. But
I would like to revisit that, because that was one of the points I wanted to bring up. We do have another caller here on the line. So we'll go to a caller and then come back and talk about that and how it impacts us even now within the progressive movement and the faith community. We've got a caller online. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm concerned about the racism aspect of all of this. I'm just terribly appalled that this morning I heard that Obama has said that his administration is going to boycott the UN racism conference that's coming up, because unless that conference takes out all relevance to or all reference to Zionism as racism and any mention of reparations. And I am just for somebody whom, you know, we're all patting ourselves on the back saying how wonderful it is that we're beyond racism now, and then, you know, his administration is doing these absolutely racist things. I'm just appalled.
Okay, thank you for your calling. Any suggestion for the caller in terms of action? I think one thing that your book does is it reminds us of the continual need to to be progressive and to be active
and vigilant.
It does remind me of a point, though, that you know today the image of Cesar Chavez is kind of as a like Latino icon, the most famous Latino, and the national, hopefully a national holiday. There's a lot of state holidays, but in his time, he was a worker. He was seen as a labor figure, and because so many Filipinos were in the fields, and there were African Americans in the fields, you know, he was not consciously promoting the aspect that I'm the Latino leader. That has happened after his death, primarily. It was a multiracial coalition, multiracial, multireligious. He, you know, so that's one of the many ways his image has kind of changed over time.
Thank you, and we'll go to our next caller.
Yes.
Good morning, caller.
Yeah, good morning. Mr. Shaw, I just have a couple of questions. I'm wondering if you have any other speaking engagements when you're here in Portland besides the one on Wednesday evening. I have to work that evening. But, and then my other question...
Unfortunately, it's my only one. I'll be in Seattle a few days later. It's the only one in Portland.
Oh, okay. Okay. Well, maybe another time. And then the other question I have is, do you feel like tactics such as becoming a human signboard and standing in front of stores would be helpful in the movement to try and organize people to boycott products from Israel? And I can take my question off the air. But thanks very much for your book. I'm looking forward to reading it
and possibly
using it in my classes.
Well, thank you. And people who cannot make the reading, beyondthefields.net is my website for the book, and they can find out everything about the book and see if they want to get it if they can't make the reading. But, you know, in terms of boycotts, and I've heard about the Israel boycott, and it's like a lot of these boycotts, I think one of the things I talk a lot in the book about is that, you know, when Caesar started his boycott, everyone said it wouldn't work, and then it worked, and then every union, every cause wanted to have a boycott. Neighbor to neighbor, I discussed, had a very successful coffee boycott. Unite Here had a hotel boycott. But there's a lot of failed boycotts.
Yes.
Because people just kind of announce a boycott without knowing what it really takes, what it involves. You have to have a huge, significant number of grassroots organizing. So if you said, would a human billboard in front of a supermarket in Portland have an impact? Well, yes, if you had those billboards all over the country.
Yes.
You know, or it was part of a sustained organizing. You just can't take one part. And like every third day we hear some group saying, I'm going to boycott this TV network, or I'm going to boycott. And those things are pretty much geared to get quick publicity. They're not serious because it takes work, staff, and money to sustain a boycott.
And long-term vision.
Yeah, it's got to be part of a larger strategy. And now, you know, what we call these things paper boycotts. It used to be the AFL-CIO had so many boycotts going and be like, oh, that's being boycotted. I mean, you know, they did have the J.P. Stevens boycott, which the movie Norma Rae was about in the wake of the UFW boycott. But, you know, the number of, it's interesting, if you look at where there's been really successful boycotts, and they have one at the Campbell Soup, the Farm Worker Labor Organizing Committee, that someone who was trained, Valdemar Velasquez, by Cesar Chavez, did a very similar thing with Campbell Soup boycott in the Midwest. But you find most of the successful boycotts have had some connection to the people from the original UFW. It's very interesting, and I trace that in the book. But, you know, you have to have more than just an announcing a boycott in one, you know, even and especially an international boycott or a national one that you're going to have people in one city. That needs to be, you know, thought a little through.
As well as thinking through tactics such as boycott, something that have often been used is hunger strike. You do a very good job in explaining the difference between a hunger strike and the spiritual fast that Mr. Chavez promoted and did several times. And you also, in other campaigns, you talk about
fast,
that.
Yeah, fast. When Cesar Chavez did his fast in 1968, people thought he was crazy. It turned out to be what he described as the greatest organizing thing he ever did, because farm workers all came down from the fields and they all wanted to be with him, and they had a religious service every night, and it was this profoundly moving and unifying experience. And then I discuss in the book a number of fasts, including through the Miami fast in 2006. But when Miami went on strike, the Janders, they called it a hunger strike. When El Maseo Medina arrived, he said, no, it's not a hunger strike, it's a fast. Because Caesar felt that a hunger strike, you're saying, I'm going to hold my breath and not eat until something happens. whereas he thought a fast sent a message, just a powerful message that I'm going to take this step. He was a very religious man, as I say. People forget this about him, that it's a cleansing process, and my adversaries, by seeing this process, their eyes will awaken.
Well, and that's part of what I had alluded to earlier about the fact that Cesar Chavez had been able to command an element in our consciousness as well as society that even now seems to be out of the reach, even out of, in many ways out of President Obama during his campaign. And that was to harness the spiritual component in society. But Cesar Chavez was able to do that. Is any market differences you can note between the two
Well, I would say the fact that Cesar became first famous in a 300-mile march from Delano to the capital of California, Sacramento, and he had the Virgin de Guadalupe behind him, and he had the great playwright and Luis Valdez, who was a farm worker activist, one of the legacy of the farm workers, who was writing about, you know, sort of combining sort of radical politics with spiritualism. I think if you look at Barack Obama's speeches before the Reverend Wright thing all happened, he would inject a lot more spirituality and talk more in those terms. I think after the Reverend Wright thing happened, he just closed that off because he didn't want to open up that door. But his original attraction to many people was that he did come off spiritual. He's not as religious a man. Cesar Chavez, it was profoundly religious. When people read this book, they're going to say, gee, I had no idea he was that religious. That's how he was able to attract so many faith-based activists to work full-time for the movement. That's how he got the Catholic Church. Everyone thinks, well, the farm workers are Catholic, and of course the church had to support him, but the growers were Catholic.
Yes.
And they were the ones funding the church.
Everything.
So, as I discuss in the book, Cesar had to use a real, they had to use a strategy helped by Robert Kennedy, who told the bishops that if you're not on the side of the farm workers, something's wrong with you, which was very nice for him to do. People saw how profoundly religious he was. It wasn't a show. It wasn't a game. It was deep felt. And that attracted a whole generation of faith-based activists who devote their lives, including Gene Ehlers, who works up here in Portland. In Local 49, who was a nun, got involved with the farm workers and said, gee, I'm going to become a labor activist. And she's doing great work through today.
Yeah.
And I have her in the book.
And we have a couple of calls.
Yeah.
Yeah, let's get to those before our time.
Yes. Good morning. You're on the air.
Yeah, good morning. I'm the one who called a moment ago about the boycotts. I had a follow-up question. What about the Coalition for Immokalee Workers? They did a lot of work here in Portland with boycotting Taco Bell, and eventually they did win.
That was a good campaign, yes.
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if you thought that was a successful form of a current-day boycott.
I think it was. That was one where they were basically trying to get people doing the various products. Taco Bell, I think it was Pepsi, with Taco Bell.
PepsiCo.
Pay one penny more.
Right.
I think that was a great campaign.
Tomatoes.
I think that was a great campaign they ran, yes.
Yeah. Okay, thank you.
And we have one more caller. Oh, okay, nope. That's it. Okay, good.
And we're speaking today with Randy Shaw, who is the author of Beyond the Fields, Cesar Chavez, the UFW, and the Struggle for Justice in the 21st Century. He will speak on this Wednesday at 6 o'clock at the Main Library downtown in Portland. And we hope that those of you who are able will be there.
I have one closing question here, which I hope might really help persuade people to get behind the idea of memorializing Cesar Chavez here in Portland. And that is, if you could point out a point or two why Americans need to recognize his contribution to our culture, to society, to labor as a whole, why we should be willing and happy to support this man.
Well, I should first say that he played an important role in Oregon in 1971 that I discuss in the book and I discuss in detail in a couple nights, because, you know, I think people don't realize he did play an important role in Oregon in stopping an anti-farm worker bill and sort of. He had a huge following in Oregon. But I think that the message here, you know, the fact that we've just elected a president on the theme of, yes, we can, I mean, really should dispel any thoughts that this is not an ongoing and active legacy. And I think that the idealism and the fact that young people, you know, who were attracted to, say, the Obama campaign, they felt, that's how people felt about the UFW. And how the fact that Cesar created this incredible organization that gave an opportunity for so many people to make a difference in the world, is really what I... So it's, I think people should see it, as opposed to where he stands on particular issues, as more of his inspiring and idealism in young people, which I think people in Portland, you know, can obviously benefit from, and everyone can. It's the inspirational model of how you live your life, that it's about justice, the pursuit of, as I say in my book, the pursuit of social justice as opposed to material goods and wealth and stepping over other people, working collaboratively. And so that's, I think, the inspiring message that he brings to the city of Portland.
And one thing in addition, we have one call. Okay. Okay, we have a call.
From San Francisco? Okay.
Good morning, caller.
Good morning.
Oh, yeah. Greetings.
Greetings.
Hey, I just wanted to add, one of the things that I learned about, whole farm workers issue was, as the rise of corporations controlling the food sources, this was something that was going on from probably the Dust Bowl days. People were losing touch with where the food was actually coming from. And one of the strengths of the United Farm Worker Movement was that it actually helped put a personhood, so to speak, on where the food was coming from. You know, if they were using poisons in the field, not only was the issue of poisoning the workers at issue, but then, well, if it's poisoning the workers, does that mean it's also poisoning us? So
yes.
It lessened the issue of it created the awareness of racism in food safety. But it also created kind of a personal control of food sources. So that was it was actually a huge advantage, kind of a double advantage,
a double benefit by pointing out the links.
What's interesting is if you've heard of Smith and Hawken, do you have that up then? Was that ever in Oregon? Smith, the company Smith Hawken, which was like an organic kind of clothing and garden supply. Dave Smith came from the farm workers movement, and the fair trade coffee, equal exchange coffee, which was head of fair trade coffee, head of other people, was a guy named Rob Everts who came out of that movement. So some of the UFW people did come and get involved, as I discussed in Beyond the Fields, in these kind of, you know, the pesticide issue resonated with them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so the whole food safety and the consciousness of where our food's grown, because that was what the farm workers were doing. They would say to people, hey, don't just eat that lettuce or eat those grapes. Think about the conditions upon which it is made. And most people hadn't really thought of that until the
yes.
UFW told them. And that is in a very enduring legacy.
Well you know, especially here in Oregon.
Yes.
You know, I did a small amount of farm working when I was a teenager, early 20s. And the idea of not providing sewage facilities or toilet facilities
yes.
for the farm workers.
Yes.
Yeah, a lot of people didn't really take that to the realization that if the farm workers didn't have an outhouse out there, then that meant that they were going to have to essentially go to the bathroom on the food and or out in the field, which was tracking it around and creating, you know, the same kinds of conditions that we're seeing with these, you know, salmonella in the foodstuffs that we're getting today. So, you know, it just was this out of sight, out of mind issue.
Right.
And hey, one last thing before you wrap up. Are you aware that there's a massive clean coal demonstration going on in D.C. today?
Am I aware?
Yeah, it's a separate
okay.
issue, but
okay. I know.
Kind of offline, but thanks for bringing it to our attention, caller.
Yeah, people are hoping that they
okay.
And vote no on any kind of clean coal legislation. It's
okay.
all
okay.
Okay, thank you.
Well, thank
you.
You know, one thing that you do very well in this book is not only tell the story of Mr. Chavez, but you also give testimony to the legacy of the UFW alumni. And I think one thing that is often missed in our organizing is to recognize who we are and where we came from. And so I want to thank you for naming names of people who've worked in countless fields over the years.
That's why I put a chart at the end of the
yes,
book, a multi-page
yeah.
chart about all the people who went on. I know the Cooper Writers, I don't know if they're
mm-hmm.
a listening group, but they're in the chart, and
yeah,
they were other faith-based activists. And there's so many people in the peace movement who've come out of the farm workers and done great work. And that's why, you know, when I'm up in your library on Wednesday night, you know, we can discuss this, discuss the renaming, and people can go to beyondthefields.net and hear more. But I think there's really something that we need to remember about how this movement has still impacts us today, and how so much of what we do is still shaped by, and is still being shaped by, those who came out of that. And we need to think about how we can create new incubators, because, mm-hmm. you know, I had hoped the Obama campaign would kind of keep its people together, so we'd have these new incubators. I wrote about it. It's not really happening the way I hoped, because you have all these young people get all excited about Obama, and then the election's over, and what are they supposed to do, go to law school?
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
yes.
You know, they need to be vehicles for people, and all of us listening who head groups and organizations need to think, hey, you know, I know AmeriCorps is going to get a big boost for the president's budget, but we need to train people as organizers, and they're our future, right?
Yes.
Well, thank you so much. We look forward to seeing you on Wednesday. Randy Shaw, the author of Beyond the Fields, will be in Portland Wednesday evening at 6 o'clock at the downtown library. I hope that those of you who are able will come and listen to him.
Well, yes. Thank you very much for having me. It's great to have community radio stations still thriving.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And let me remind our listeners that coming up at next is Lori Mercier talks with environmental law professor Mary Wood about what citizens are doing about global warming. Bill Resnick interviewed labor movement journalist Sam Pizzagatti about Obama's economic program, and Clayton Morgeridge has commentary on biology and progressive politics. 10 is a new time for Air Cascadia with Chris Andre and Liam Delta. At 10:15, also a new time for If You Love This Planet with Dr. Helen Caldicott. At 11 here, Health Watch at a new time. Host David Naiman.
There you go.
And at 11:30 on Sounds of Awareness, a new day and a new time. Host Paul Van Dyke speaks with Dr. Chris Cook, a successful naturopathic physician who is blind.
Well, see, there it is. All of these have their roots and work either started or promoted by Cesar Chavez. So you find that we've got someone here who has laid down a great foundation for community activism, community involvement, and your connection with KBOO.